Hello and welcome to Horrible Friends Condensed Spoop, a smaller, shorter version of our normal show where we talk about new horror movies, review those horror movies, and talk about anything related to the horror genre. I'm Chris, and once again, I'm joined by Swayze and Mike John. How's it going, boys?
It's going.
I'm here. Present and accounted for.
All right, super excited to do this one today. So, for our listeners, last week we released part one of the Netflix series Follow the House of Usher, spoiler-filled review, and today we're going to be wrapping that up and talking about the quick talk about the last four episodes, and then just kind of ramble on about how we felt about the series as a whole. So if you still haven't watched the series yet, please go do that, and you know, check out our last episode so you know what the hell we're talking about. So let's just go ahead and dive right in. So we left off with episode four, and then, you know, this series comes back hard with its second half, starting with my favorite, or episode based on my favorite story, The Telltale Heart.
It's also my favorite story. I think it was what really gravitated me towards Edgar Allan Poe's work when I was a kid in school.
It was definitely the one I was more curious about how they were going to translate it to a modern day, since every single episode has that that kind of like twist to it. I wanted to see what they were going to do with it.
No, me too, because yeah, it was the first Poe story I read that really pulled me in. And like I said last week, when I right before I started watching the series, I looked at all the episode titles and I saw that one, so I was really interested to see how it was going to go. And then once we saw early on with Victorine and you know, what she was working on, like that, what the hell was she doing? Like that heart thing.
Like a pacemaker kind of device.
Yeah.
The heart sock.
Yeah, the heart sock. That's a good word for it. Once I saw that, I was like, okay, so it's going to have to do something with that.
In terms of its like adaptation from that story, I'm a sucker for like a good, well synced post-production team. So like the sound editing and everything that went into this episode really brought home like the Telltale Heart aspect of it. Like the fact that this episode begins with a blacked out screen and you just hear the beating, you already know where it's going, but that tension's already like laid down right away.
Yeah, it was super well done. And like just like a quick idea of what happens, you know, the way all the last episodes went, obviously this one's about Victorine. It ends with her, and she basically wants to try and get this heart thing going. And pretty much in the end, it just leads with her killing her, I guess her, was it her wife or just like her partner, her girlfriend? I don't know if they were actually married or anything.
I think it was just her partner. I don't think they were ever married.
Okay, I wasn't sure. But just like the Telltale Heart story, she kills her partner. And just to, in her insanity of thinking she can make this heart device work, she killed her partner, propped up her body, and just had it attached to her partner's dead heart. And throughout the entire episode, you just hear basically like a squelching sound of this heart sock on her partner's heart. And the way I described this to Swayze outside of the recording was, you know, they filmed it and I could just see, you know, the editing and the sound effects team calling Mike Flanagan or just shooting him a text saying like, okay, Mike, so what do you want to do with like the budget for this episode? And he just called them in like a cold sweat, just going squelching noises.
I think my response to that was the audio was so moist. That was my only comment. It was everything sounded wet.
It had a, it had like a squeakiness to it. And it's funny because it took me back to another popular, Telltale Heart adaptation, which is SpongeBob's Rubber Boots, because all I kept on thinking was of those like squeaking boots that Mr. Krabs took.
I enjoyed it. I liked that how they brought it into like the newer, you know, world. I also really enjoyed that for like a glimpse moment we got to see that Verna is capable but doesn't all the time, is capable of possessing people and basically making them do whatever she wants without just kind of guiding them. She can just make them do it. Because we didn't see a whole lot of her, but we got to see that happen when right before she kills herself, because it's a complete like personality change.
I really enjoyed how they also like buried it way in advance. Like you didn't know, you knew, because you know it's the Telltale Heart. You know what goes into this story, but they didn't reveal exactly what happened until later. So you don't know about like the surgery or the piece attached to her until, you don't even know that she killed her until like the very end of the episode when everything is revealed and her mind completely cracks. So I liked how there's this something happened, but what happened and why is it driving her down this path?
Yeah, and honestly, what I think I enjoyed the most is that this is also like the first one that Roderick actually saw happen. Like all the other kids, he, you know, was found out the next day that they died. He went to see Victorine and he watched, saw what she did and watched her kill herself. And I was like, that's fucking nuts.
It's definitely got to do something to a man's psyche, not only to see like his children die and know that it's his fault, but like out of all of his kids, she was clearly the most regal and like well presented out of all of them, and probably went out in the most, I'd say, like opposite way of her character.
Absolutely. So yeah, we're just going to keep moving along. So yeah, basically what happens in the Telltale Heart episode. And then we move on to the Goldbug episode, which is all about Tammy and her, you know, knockoff goop idea.
This is one of the short stories I was not well versed in. I guess from the best I know is that there's some sort of like treasure hunt involved with it. Does anybody else know that story that well?
I don't know anything about that story, to be completely honest with you. I just felt bad for the entire episode, like more so than anybody else, because it's just like, God, you really slowly watched her go insane, knowing full well she couldn't do anything about it, even though she wanted to. And yeah, like I just felt bad. I mean, I didn't really like her character to begin with, but still, I was just like, Christ, just let it end already.
Yeah, no, as much as like she was one of the characters I hated the most up to this point, I think she was the first one that I felt a little bit bad for when she died. Because she was the only one at the end that I feel like kind of like accepted that like she fucked up. Like she even says it, like, I fucked it up. I fucked everything up. You know, no one else said that. Everyone else was just like, yeah, I suck. And they just died, or, you know, they just lost their shit and just, you know, were gone. She was the only one that seemed to like just kind of admit that she fucked up.
I think you get some of that sympathy in the episode too, because she's really the only one up to that point that Verna gives like a second and third and fourth chance to have a peaceful death. Like she keeps on trying to stop her from going down this self-destructive path that's going to be painful and miserable for her.
Well, I think that there's a few of the kids that she does that to, because she does that to Leo as well. She gives him a chance to like turn away and it not be the outcome that he's racing towards. And she does the same with her, but she's just so cracked under the pressure and overwhelmed that she just ignores all of it and just keeps pushing forward.
I did like that when Tammy finally went, like the last words, like she just wanted it to be over. And just the way Verna kind of like said it to her, like, you just want to sleep, you know? And then that's when she's gone. And, you know, a giant mirror explodes shards of glass everywhere and like stab her in all different parts of her body. So she doesn't simply go. Definitely painful.
A very brutal, slow motion death. Just like watching the glass fall through her. And then you have that piece that was like right in her back. And then like the pieces that landed in her throat and her face. Like definitely a memorable kill for the year.
Yeah. And much like a lot of parts in the show, like it was shot so well, like it was so well done.
Like, I've never been one to try to break something that's on a ceiling, but like if I was gonna, that's not the fucking way I'd do it. I don't know why she felt compelled to do it that way. Like, no, this is the best option to break this mirror on my ceiling.
Is to jump up towards it, make my back parallel to the bed, and fling bar. This fire poker.
She's right. A 10-year-old in 1999 who just saw The Matrix, and it was just trying to recreate his favorite scenes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. All right, well, to quickly move along again, then we have the almost final episode, the seventh episode, The Pit and the Pendulum, which we are now down to only one Usher child, and that is Frederick.
Quite the arc for Frederick, I'll have to say, because he starts out and you kind of get the idea that he's pathetic, but you don't ever think that he's going to devolve into this the biggest monster of them all by the end.
Oh, yeah, like... he deserves everything that comes to him.
My man went from pussy to Papuccino. Just like, I'm going to go full-blown Scarface, sniff all the crack, pull people's teeth out. I hated him so much.
Oh, yeah. Like, he just lost it. He got that little bit of coke from Leo, and then coke was his favorite thing in the world, besides abusing his already, like, burnt and traumatized wife. Like, I get... she lied about where she went, and she ended up going to Perry's orgy party. But you know what she did at the orgy party? She had a drink, stood there, and then her skin melted.
She definitely, like, visually, you can see that she regrets her decision while she's there, too. Which, us knowing that, makes us hate him even more.
And who knows what the fuck he did, like, throughout their marriage. Especially how, like, he kind of devolves and, like, how he talks to Lenore throughout it. Because, like, he brings his wife to their home to, like, quote, take care of her, and he just kind of tortures her. And even how when Lenore kind of calls him out in his shit, he pulls the, like, I'm rich and my daddy's rich card, like the, you know, you don't fucking talk to me like that. Anyone who talks to me like that gets, you know, has repercussions. And, like, you just pulled that shit on your daughter.
It's interesting you say that, because of all the siblings, he's the most like Roderick in a lot of ways. His wife is probably the closest to Roderick's first wife in terms of them being these, like, very genuine, kind characters that are, they kind of have, like, a strong moral compass. And I think if, like, if it wasn't for the curse, Frederick definitely goes on to become the spinning image of his father. He's definitely done or will do the things that Roderick has done.
Yeah, don't the rest of the siblings call him, like, Frederick most of the time?
Yeah, because he's like a false image of his dad.
Yeah. Well, to basically wrap up what happens to Frederick, you know, he tortures his wife, and he mixes together, like, nightshade and then some kind of, like, liquid to inject into her so she's aware of what's happening, but she can't move. And we have no idea what he does, like, the several times he does this to her, but the last time he does it to her, he grabs pliers and pulls out all of her teeth.
And it is rough to watch.
Yeah, like, you don't see any of the teeth pulling happen, like, it's a quick cut. Like, so, at first when he goes in, like, oh, he's gonna pull out a tooth, and then it quickly cuts to him putting down a bloodied tin of Altoids. And you hear multiple jingles in there, so you know it wasn't just a fang he pulled.
Those aren't mints.
No, they were teeth. All of her teeth.
And I think he had a monologue earlier. He talked about how her smile was, like, hypnotizing to him, and he resented it now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because I think he just viewed it as, like, a lie. Like, just because she lied about where she went that night and, you know, ended up hurt from it. But he just took that as, like, your smile is just a lie to me now.
I mean, she already had skin like bacon. He didn't need to take her teeth.
You know, that's a fair point. It's fair point. And then he just goes off to, like, the same building where this shit happened in the first episode with Perry and all the liquid meat people.
The fuckening.
Yeah, the fuckening. And, you know, he does a little bit more coke. And then he goes to, like, piss on the ground there to, like, shit on Perry's, you know, memory. And then he gets paralyzed and falls down. And it turns out Verna, for the first time, like, stepped in and really took a hold of the situation and basically forced him to pour some of the nightshade paralytic into his coke.
Yeah, she really made a point to let him know that she fucking hated his guts.
So I'm going to disagree with you a tiny bit with the stepping in part, because she mentions that she normally doesn't do it. But I feel like she stepped in a little bit with Victorine, too, because she wanted to send a message to Roderick. But the way that she steps in on this one, she just does it because she doesn't fucking like him.
she like even makes that very well known to him, like, I'm doing this because I don't fucking like you.
No, yeah, it was definitely the first time she stepped in that was the main, you know, catalyst to the child's death. You know, like you said, Victorine, it was mainly because she was trying to send a message to Roderick. It was nothing personal against Victorine, but this time it was 100% like personal message towards Roderick. I'm sorry, not Roderick, Frederick.
Oh yeah, absolutely. She was just like, yeah, no, normally I don't do this. This could have gone a bunch of different ways, but fuck you. It's going to go this way because I want you to suffer.
Yeah, she said, but you had to pull out those pliers.
Yeah, and then she brings up something about, like, in another life, he was going to be a dentist in another episode, which is wild.
Yeah, like, my thought on that was basically, like, if, you know, Roderick and Madeline didn't, you know, go on the path that they did to become, like, so rich and powerful and, like, heads of the Fortunato company, like, and they just went on to have, like, average Joe lives, like, I think that's what, you know, would have happened with Frederick.
I think it adds more questions to the lore of what she is. Because now she has insight into alternate timelines and what different paths these characters could have taken. Because I remember we mentioned in the past that we thought of her as an angel of death. But she takes on a different form than any of that now, I think.
So I have thoughts on that. But I would like to save it for after we discuss the last episode. Because I don't want to ramble on too much.
Yeah, we don't want to get too ahead of ourselves. But just to wrap up the pendulum, you know, building starts getting demolished by the construction crews outside. Frederick's just on the ground, paralyzed, but still aware. And sure enough, in the destruction, a pendulum-like object comes down and just slowly gets lower and lower and cuts him in half as he's still alive.
So well deserved.
So well deserved. And I feel like he almost got off easy, honestly.
I mean, his dick was out. So did he really, though? They're going to find his body and be like, why was his dick out when he died?
True. I mean, you know, it wasn't out when the camera cut to us because, you know, I guess Netflix doesn't want to show, you know, doesn't want to show full dong in a murder situation, I guess.
You don't want to see Elliot's dick?
No.
Not only that, but like, why was his dick out? In the confirmed orgy house, raises eyebrows.
Yeah, you know, that does raise eyebrows. The, you know, orgy house where his wife was. All right, well, let's go right into the last episode, The Raven, which we will then just basically morph into our full final discussion on the series itself. So I think my big thing with The Raven episode, it was one of my favorite episodes of the series itself. But I feel like it was also the one with, like, the least amount of scares, and I was very okay with it.
I can agree. Yeah, there was so much left in the second half of this series that needed to be unpacked that I feel like the last episode needed to tie up some of those loose ends, and because of that, we didn't have a whole lot of scare factor, but we did get a lot of background story, more about Roderick and Madeline, more about Verna and who she is and what she does, more about Pym. There was so much we learned in such a short amount of time, and they still had time to throw in a jump scare just to ensure us that it's still a horror show.
Yeah, like there wasn't that many, but for the few that there were, they were done pretty well.
It's just a testament to Flanagan's his mastery as like a screenwriter. Like much like Hill House, every little piece intricately fits into each other. You know, he sets everything up in that first episode, and throughout the course of this, everything falls into place to the point where he has some of the most satisfying endings to any like film or series that I ever watch anymore. Like that, you feel fulfilled by the end of these runs because they're just so well put together, and you really care for these characters, even if they're pieces of shit like the ones in this are.
I wholeheartedly agree. Just watching this and being caught up in the way he tells stories just made me want to rewatch Hill House and Bly Manor all over again. And I still haven't seen the other one that came out recently. Chris told me to watch it. I just forgot. But
The Midnight Club.
Yeah. So I still have that one that I can watch. But like, I just want to rewatch his stuff again.
Yeah, there's a few people that were in this series that were in Midnight Club. His his young wife in this series. She is in Midnight Club. The guy who played Perry's in Midnight Club. And I think one of Camille's assistants, she was in Midnight Club as well.
I think you can really tell that something is really well written, especially when it comes to like short form television like this, when we can all just like name drop the characters and know exactly what each and every one of them is about. Like if you can refer to them as like people that you know, that just shows the quality of these characters and the quality of the writing.
Yeah. And before we get too much into just talking about the show itself, let's do a, I guess, a quick wrap up of The Raven itself. Like you guys said, it's pretty much bringing everything to a head that was laid out in the first episode or the first few. And, you know, we finally see what happened to Griswold, you know, Roderick's asshole of a boss back in 1979, and that how he screwed Augie over all those years ago by agreeing to be a whistleblower, but then just kind of turning on that and being the golden boy for the company and making him look great, and what shot him and Madeline up to basically the heads of the company, like almost nearly overnight. But also when after finding out what happened to Griswold, you know, we see the actual deal that Roderick and Madeline made with Verna, and basically that, you know, they would get everything they wanted, you know, money and power, and, you know, they would never be able to be, you know, prosecuted, or, you know, any negativity of them would never come to light, which explains why in the beginning when Augie said, you know, so many charges have been put against the Ushers, but, you know, nothing ever sticks. So that explains that. And then she basically just tells them that, like, you know, yeah, you'll get all this, and the only payment is that, you know, the next generation has to pay the tab.
Which is some pretty dark stuff, if you think about it, because they were so wrapped up in themselves and their own success that they didn't take 5 seconds to think about the children that they may or may not have, and consider that they'll have to suffer for their sins, and then they'll suffer for those sins as well.
It's a very good allegory, too, for, I think, what the show is talking about. You know, the idea of the rich are very present-minded and don't think about the ramifications of the next generation. I mean, there's a whole monologue about it later, but I think it's very encompassed in that moment. You know, live for the moment, live for the now. Enjoy your milk and honey, but don't save any for the next in line.
Basically, that the boomers enjoy everything, and, you know, all the millennials and Gen Z just get fucked over, you know?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Chris, did this just become personal for you, bud? Do you need a hug? You want to talk about it?
No, it's fine. I'm okay. I'm just fine.
Well, I guess while Chris is crying, me and Mike can discuss more further about the Raven episode. So they do go over the deal in a lot of depth and explain that, like Chris said, that it's, they're basically immune until she says they're not, from everything. And it really is everything.
Yeah, like no matter what they do, like they can't get arrested for anything. They can't, like, they basically just have like a golden ticket through to the day they die.
And basically that, you know, it doesn't end until they're both gone. Like, it starts with them and it will end with them.
And I think they try to cheat the system because Roderick tries to kill himself, and Verna, she intervenes because he can't die until everybody else dies.
Well, no, he thinks about killing himself in one of the episodes. I think it may have been the Telltale Heart one. Like, he thinks about it then, but he doesn't. But it's actually Madeline that convinces him to, like, pop a bunch of, like, their meds and for him to go out.
I think it's actually the Gold Bug episode, because he talks about Victorine being dead. And then I think it's because, yeah, he goes from her house to the office and then just paces around in the office. And then that's when I forgot her name. Lenore comes in and she's like, oh, are you OK? And he's like, yeah, no, I'm fine. Why aren't you in school? Like, he's acting like it's just a normal day because he hasn't been to sleep yet.
Oh, yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, like Madeline basically tries to, like, you know, cheat the system and find a loophole and just have Roderick, you know, kill himself. So then, you know, everything ends and she gets to take over the company.
She's just like the stone cold bitch of the series. Like everybody's been awful, but she, you can tell that she's just a sociopath. Like she's willing to throw everybody, including her own brother, under the bus by the end of this. And I mean, she kind of gets her own comeuppance too, I guess.
I've never met a female character in a show that more perfectly describes every female Disney villain wrapped up into one until I met this lady. Like, tell me I'm wrong. Like,
no, that's pretty accurate.
You're not wrong.
Like, remember what was in the flashbacks, Roderick's wife, she's like genuinely concerned about him. And she's like, Madeline says, oh, that's real. You really actually care. I thought you were just like she said something like sucking his dick just to get ahead or something.
But yeah, she's basically like, I thought you were just playing the part.
Yeah.
I didn't know this was real for you.
Like, I think she can't fathom genuine tenderness from anybody.
Or any kind of emotion.
Yeah.
So I think the one thing that I had this realization in this episode, like the whole time I was like, God, I just hope Lenore survives because like she is like the best of the family. And like you said before, she is basically like, you know, the new younger version of Roderick's original wife, Annabelle Lee. Like she is that warm, caring person. And then once Verda says that line in the beginning talking about the deal, like, you know, the deal doesn't end until, you know, your bloodline is gone. And I'm just like, oh, Lenore is part of the bloodline.
She did.
They did a very good job of concealing her death throughout the series, though, with the whole AI text messaging that Roderick was getting. Because they just like completely like conceal that to the very end that she's dead.
Yeah, and I think I like that one as much as it hurt, and I hated for her character to be gone. I like that, you know, Verna said for a lot of these, you know, it wasn't personal. And this one, I feel like she really tried to make it known to Lenore, like, this isn't personal. This is nothing against you. You are the best of them.
It's kind of sweet in a way, because she like comes to her, she's in her room, she's sad, and she's just kind of like, I'm sorry, honey. Like, I really don't want to do this. And then just taps her. And she just goes to sleep. Like, she could have ruined her, done all kinds of crazy stuff to her, and she just goes, take a nap.
Yeah, and at least I think she also helps her ease into it a little bit by like telling her that, you know, after this, like, her mom goes on, her mom's able to survive from, you know, the teeth pulling, all the skin grafts, she's able to go through physical therapy, and she gets, you know, a sizable chunk of money from, you know, the company crumbling, and she donates so much of it, makes a nonprofit named after Lenore, and like saves so many lives from it. And so I think that also was just like a really nice touch.
It's visually, it's what I wanted from this series, because I wanted to see what would happen if someone accepted her offer of a peaceful death. She always gives them an out and an opportunity to walk away, and we never get to see it. And I think it's because she gave into it. Lenore gave into it. We see what happens when you don't give into your vices and you don't, when you look outside of yourself into other people. Because every single one of the other siblings, their death is basically a death in their own making. Like, Verna didn't really have much to do with it, except for the case of Frederick and the other one's escaping me right now. But they kind of all put themselves into those horrible positions.
So after Lenore is gone, we cut back to Augie and Roderick talking in the old Usher house, and Roderick basically finally finishing the story. And this is where we find out, you know, Madeline has been down in the basement the whole time, and Roderick, as far as he knew, had, quote, killed her, and, you know, and cut out her eyes and put in, like, jade stones in her eyes so she could, you know, be dead like the great Queen Cleopatra, as Verna called her. But she wasn't actually dead, so she comes up the stairs screaming and starts strangling Roderick. And then the house starts to crumble. Augie gets out of there. The house falls, and both Madeline and Roderick die together. as they were meant to. And then we have a lovely, just beautiful Edgar Allan Poe like monologue done by Verna at the cemetery where all the ushers are buried, and the camera pans out and it's done. All right, now before we wrap this up, would you guys give me like your quick thoughts on the series as a whole? And then I've got like one extra little thing I want to mention before we're done here.
I think it was just overall a slam dunk. I think Hill House was the highest of highs for me when that first dropped. I had never seen anything like that. I've never seen a horror story make me feel the way that made me feel. And I thought that everything that Flanagan had done afterwards was good, but it never reached that height. And I think this reaches that height. House of Usher is the grim alternative to Hill House. And there are just so many iconic characters, so many well-written scenes. I wanted to talk about three before I gave away my time. You know, the one that really stood out to me was Mark Hamill's scene, his last big scene when he comes in, he tries to basically poison Verna and kill her and wrap her up. And then she just like magicians herself into another part of the room. She's like, yeah, I was just fucking with you. Let's have a talk. And like, she tries to get him in on the deal too. And he basically talks about how, you know, the way he did, well, I don't know how to describe what he says, but the impression I got from it by the end was that he knew he had done bad shit, and he's just ready to just like, he's willing to just take it and face it rather than go down the same path that Roderick went down. I just another stunning scene by Mark Hamill. The other one was with just the retelling of the Raven when Roderick, he basically just word for word quotes the Raven poem, and we see it play out in the room after he discovers Lenore. And then there's another, the last one is the poem, I mean, not the poem, the monologue that Augie says at the end when he talks about how these giants of industry, how small they are compared to him, who has tender relationships and has a family. And he may not have the riches they have, but he has more in his own life than they ever experienced, which is true, because all these people, when you really watch them in the series, are incredibly lonely people. They try to fill up this void of emptiness with these things and these pleasures, and all it ends up doing is destroying them.
Now, the reason I bring Mike John to the show is because he will always give us these beautiful, insightful reviews and descriptions of things, because he's very smart.
Well, thank you. I mean, I went to college, you know. But no, I mean, this is just, it's beautiful. It's a visual poetry, this entire series. I can't praise this enough.
I wasn't sure how I was going to feel about the series. I was very excited because it's Edgar Allan Poe, and like Flanagan always does, really good work. So I was excited, but at the same time, I'm like, I have high hopes. I don't want it to be let down. And it wasn't. None of my hopes were let down. I enjoyed it all the way through. I hated the characters. I felt bad for them, even though I hated them. It touched parts of my emo kid soul that had been buried for years from the poetry. The imagery was fantastic. There wasn't a single part in this show where I was actually bored and like, I'm going to look at my phone. Like I couldn't. And Verna as a character, otherwise on the internet known as the Raven, because then we find out at the end that she is the Raven. Like, she's more than just like this death goddess or god. She's an entity. She's everywhere and anywhere all at the same time. She is just ever present. Like, it's nuts that this is all going on in the background while we're trying to figure out how each of them is going to die and what's going to happen to each of them. And then at the end, it's almost like it was a game to her. She's at the graveyard and she puts a piece on each of their tombstones that is almost like a totem for each of them that reminds her of them and about the choices that they made to get them to that point. And she's the only one that knows like what's going to happen, when it's going to happen, and what would have happened if they didn't do all this. And I was so visually entertained. Like, I want a whole series on just Verna and like her going around and making deals. I would be so entertained by that. But the show overall, awesome. It was fantastic. I can't praise it enough. Hill House is still my favorite. This is a very, very close second. I'm probably going to watch it again. I'm going to make the girlfriend watch it. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I don't really have much else to say. Nothing I say would be as, you know, clever as what you two said, but I'm just going to leave it with that this show got announced like 2 years ago, and I was so excited as soon as I saw it, and I was searching for information on it leading up to when production finally started and was following it. And just couldn't wait for this. And just like both of you, I was so excited and I wasn't disappointed at all. Loved every moment of it, was sucked into every moment of it. And I loved it. It was fantastic. I don't know if I'd like it more than Hill House. I feel like I have to watch Hill House again and then I'd have like a better answer for that. But at least as of right now, it's one of my favorite series I've ever seen. And before we wrap it up, I just want to leave it with one last little bit. So, we all loved Bruce Greenwood as Roderick, right?
Hell to the fucking yes.
Love him. Yeah, I really did. Very passionate. He did a great job.
All right, so would it surprise you to know that Bruce was not the original Roderick and didn't get the job as Roderick until 4 months after filming had already started?
Pray, Chris. Who was the original Roderick?
It was Frank Langella, or Langella, I think his name is.
Can I have a face to that name? Because I'm terrible with names.
Yeah, I'll send it to you in our messenger. But he was the original Roderick. And, you know, they filmed for about 4 months. And then there was some kind of like, you know, not good allegations happening on set. And then he was fired.
Well, the guy they got, he knocked it out of the park. I mean, he just has that stoic, you know, like he's been so rich, he's detached from everything, kind of element to him. It's an excellent performance.
Yeah, and honestly, I'm so glad that it ended up being Bruce Greenwood because he was just flawless.
I'm real glad they picked him because the guy that you sent us looks like a human living liver spot.
It looks like Christopher Plummer's like unsuccessful brother.
All right, well, thanks you guys for joining me on this. I was so excited to do this for the show, and I'm glad we're able to hurry up and watch, you know, all, you know, 8 hours, nearly 9 hours of content to be able to talk about it in a nice short, you know, hour. But I'd like to thank Connor McLeod for our artwork. I'd like to thank Andy Cavanaugh for our music. You can see all their information in the description down below. And, you know, follow us on all of our social media. You know, all of that's linked in the description. And before we go, Swayze, if Verna asks you what your threshold qualifier is and if you want to make a deal, what would you say?
Thanks for stopping by for a hot episode. Outro music.